This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith, here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hi, everyone.
And we are here at Arno's Restaurant in the Garment Center in New York City. And this is the Retail Marketing Society's regular kind of lunch and learn speaker series.
And networking, fabulous
and networking. And Retail Marketing Society is an interesting group. It's a nonprofit organization. And we have two of the board members here, Robin Lewis, who is the CEO of The Robin Report. And he's the author of Retail Seismic Shift and other books. And Jan Rogers Niffen, who is the CEO of J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide, and a frequent CNBC commentator about the retail industry. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So the title for this event, for those who are here attending in the audience, was Apocalypse Wow. Which of you came up with that title?
We've been talking about the apocalypse forever, and the wow part you came up with.
Oh, good, yeah.
Oh, that was Larry.
Okay. Larry.
Does that mean it's old news now?
The apocalypse?
Mm.
People keep using it. I mean, I keep seeing it crops up in articles all over the place.
So... What?
The apocalypse is not over. Folks.
This is all of these stores closing, chains not doing good business and closing, and the landscape has changed. And some people haven't adjusted.
The consumer is as healthy as the consumer's been in 25 years, and we're still going to see record store closings, and we're going to see record retail bankruptcies in 2018, exceeding the record we saw in 2017. So the retail apocalypse is not over, but it's certainly changing in character. But it's so much easier to be a retailer, pardon me for saying this, when the consumer's fabulous. And a lot of retailers are out there right now thinking they actually solved all their problems, and it turns out they're standing on third base because there was a past pitch. Just, you know, the retail environment is much better than most people have seen it in this room in most of their careers.
So who
are
the...
I would add to that. First of all, I totally agree. The apocalypse is not over for many, but for the rest, and we'll probably get into naming a few. We kind of call it a renaissance, and we're in the very early stages of this technology revolution, if you want to call it that, and very early stages. So it's hard to really. Define exactly who those retailers are going to be who are going to make the transformation successfully into the new world. But yes, apocalypse for many, and it'll continue, and 2018 is going to be tough. Yeah.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. Last night I happened to be at a retail accelerator where a bunch of young new companies were presenting, here's what we can do in the world of retail and retail tech, as well as the first class that came back and said, here's what happened to us. There's been six classes go through this accelerator.
Was this XRC this morning?
Yeah.
I missed it. I was coming to set up for
last night they had cocktails and they had them all there.
Yeah, this was the XRC Labs demo day was today.
Right. The preview for that was last night.
Yeah.
And so
that's attached to Parsons.
A small group of us were there for this preview, and six of the companies gave their stories, and two that had already gone through the program gave their stories. And if you don't think retail is really changing fast, and if you don't think technology is what's changing it, you only have to spend about 2 hours with a bunch of 25-year-olds who have started brand new companies that are actually working to change retail. It's changing really fast.
Okay, so before we even talk about how it's changing and who would be a good example, talk a little bit. I know recently looking at sales, Macy's and Saks and maybe even The Gap are performing well. So how do you think, what made that happen? I consider that a little bit of a turn in a positive direction.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, Macy's is doing better. And, you know, Jan's going to follow after me because he's got the numbers locked in.
He knows
what's
everything.
Going on. Even though their numbers are looking better, I'm very cautious about my opinion about where they are. And Gap, I have problems totally with the Gap, and I'm not so sure Saks is doing that well.
How would you
You haven't seen anything I disagree with so far.
Okay, but you add to that because you've got some of the financial background.
How would you describe Macy's right now in terms of where it's reaching and what it's trying to do and what's working?
I'd like to weigh in on that.
Please.
First of all, the total sea level has been reorganized and changed. They have a bunch of young people in there who are extremely intelligent, Jeff Gannett being one of them, is CEO, and I've talked to several of them, and they do know what they have to do, and they do know how they have to do it to make it successfully in this new world. And it's big-time technology, and they are moving in the right direction. The biggest issue they have... First of all, there are four barriers for all these legacy companies: leadership, culture, capital, and speed. So I would say that the C-level group at Macy's, they do have the leadership. They are changing their culture. They do have the capital. They would say the biggest fear they have is speed, because they know that even though 9 out of 10 of these startups will fail, the 1 out of 10 here, the 1 out of 10 there, the 1 out of 10 over here, and you aggregate all those over the next few years, and you're going to have a bunch of speedboats that are going to be taking huge chunks of share out of these big old legacy department stores and retailers. That's why speed. Everybody said, why? What about speed? That is why speed, because they really have to get, and that's why Walmart is blowing up their whole model and moving some, you know, got some experts, and I'm sure Jan's heard this as well, who say you're nuts. The guy is, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's going in 20, 30 different directions. But that is try often and fail fast, and Walmart's doing it. Anyway, I could go on, but you can go on as well.
I'm 100% on your wavelength of what the issues and what makes them work are. But taking it from the top down, if you look at the top layer being the Tiffany's, the Saks, the Lord & Taylor's, the Nordstrom's, that part. I'm not talking about Hermes and Louis Vuitton and Versace and all that. But from the top layer we think of here in the States as far as the retail third-party sellers, Lord & Taylor's practically gone already, and it's going to be gone for all practical purposes. It may still be a website or something or a handful of stores. But when you close the big store, it's going away. Saks is struggling. Now, Saks is doing relatively well right now, but my God, the upper-end consumer couldn't be doing better. So this is not a long-term process with Saks. They've been struggling. I don't see them not struggling going forward. The company's not is undercapitalized. Once you look at HBC, they've been doing some restructuring, but they don't really have the money to put back into all the businesses they need to put it back into. So I don't see a bright future for L&T or Saks, either one. But Nordstrom's is well capitalized, and they're doing all the right stuff. And no, they didn't buy themselves out, and thank God they didn't, because it turned out the consumer was turning and their business was turning at the same time they were trying to do that. Their stock price is higher now than where they tried to buy it out. They're going to own that space, and they can crawl up. There's nobody up there. They can fill whatever goes away at Saks and Lord & Taylor. So that space can be Nordstrom's, and the reason it can be is because they're well capitalized, they're maximum taxpayers. They can reinvest that 14% difference in tax rate, 14 percentage point difference in tax rate back into the business. You have to be well capitalized, a maximum taxpayer, and you have to be using the money back in the business to be an online player, or you're going to lose. And the next sector down is the same story, and the next sector down is Macy's. Macy's is going to win. Bon-Ton's already going away. There's no need for Boscov's and Dillard's and all those other people. Dillard's won't go away because they're too well capitalized, but they're going to be a small regional player. Macy's owns that space. The next step down is Kohl's. They're going to own that space because JCPenney and Sears are not going to be there.
Yep.
And then when you go down from there, there's Walmart, Target, and Amazon. Now, I think Target's doing a great job, but tell me, when you say the words Walmart, Amazon, and Target all in the same breath, who doesn't belong? It's going to be a tough road for Target going forward. They may carve out a niche and win, but boy, it's not going to be easy. And then you just go on down from there, right? Dollar Tree, Dollar General.
Okay,
right,
wait. So I'm trying to stay a little positive here because okay. I feel positive on all the ones I just said.
Hold on. No, but I didn't answer your other question about the Gap. You have to take the Gap brand. When you talk about Gap Inc., Old Navy and Banana Republic, surprisingly, they're both doing well. The Gap brand is not doing well. They're still in deep trouble.
Okay.
So I just wanted to clarify.
But there was hope
there. I didn't
even
get to the mall.
And I'm not hounding.
In the mall.
No one's getting to the mall. That's the problem.
Exactly.
I'm not just concentrating on Macy's, but I think it is a good example that a traditional brand can start to turn themselves around.
Yes.
So I think it is positive. And I love the fact that they bought Story.
Yep.
So now I also just read that Saks divested itself of Gilt. So
First of all, they bought Rachel Shechtman at Macy's because Story may work in a lot of their locations, and if Story gets traffic, they can probably be a fun place to go.
but you're right; they really bought Rachel,
And what she is going to do, and what they are doing, is they are reimagining. They got 50 stores identified, which they are reimagining, and they are rethinking how they are going to turn not only Herald Square but these other 50 stores into go-to destination experiences. And whatever that is, I don't know. I mean, they're testing all kinds of stuff. They're testing market at Macy's within Herald Square. Some people say it's a little bit disorganized and flimsy, they're learning from this and they know it. That's Macy's moving in the right direction.
So just as you mentioned, and we'll come back to stores, but the experience economy, like where is it going? Has it peaked? Is it on its way? What will it be about?
You want to start?
Who will win?
I do not think the experience economy has peaked.
I don't
think
either.
That retailers are learning to play in the experience economy. That's the reason they bought Story. That's what you have to do now. I tell this story all the time, and I'm telling it one more time. So the CEO of a major firm who develops real estate property says to me one day, Jan, you know, when you and I got in the business, we used to build malls, and then we had to put in some places for people to have something to eat and drink. They take a little rest and go back in the store and shop and all that. Now we build the mall. We fill it full of restaurants to get them to come there, and we hope they buy something on the way out. It has become an experiential economy. That's what's going on out there. And we're going to do more and more of that. But people can still win that are traditional stores. Macy is going to win their space, and they're going to win it by doing the kind of stuff you just said. But if you can't do that, or you can't afford to do it because you don't have the money to reinvest in your business,
Penny.
You're toast.
Yep.
Now, luxury is an experience.
Ron Johnson had a great idea at Penny's.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it couldn't be executed in the environment he was working in. So he blew $1 billion and put the place into near bankruptcy. But it wasn't because he had bad ideas. He was doing the exact right thing from the point of view of what you would want your store to look like and be.
I in my Robin report, took huge hits from people. In fact, Terry Lundgren being one of them. I was on Ron Johnson's side from the very beginning. I said, just what Jan said, this guy's got the right vision for where the department stores have to go in the future. And if you look at where the department stores are going, they're going towards what Ron Johnson, what his vision was, but his execution was miserable. I mean, overnight, he got rid of all the promotions, therefore he fired all of his boomer middle-class customers, and they never came back. But the vision is this. First of all, when I tell tell Jeff Gannett this and several of them who I talk to, the first thing you need to do is extract two words from your head, retail store. Because when you hear or say retail store, what automatically comes to mind is a big building full of stuff. You have to start using different language, maybe call a platform, which is a word that's starting to be used now. And you can do anything on that platform. You can have experience, and you can put everybody's products or anybody's, even competitors. You and Children's Place, Macy's, could lease space, and Children's Place could put actual shops right on their platform. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that starting to happen as well. Look at Amazon. That is Amazon's whole thing. They are a platform, their marketplace globally. They can put anything and everything on there. And you watch. And Walmart and Amazon are going to prove this. You're going to see designer brands going on both of those platforms. And the reason you're going to see that is they can't avoid the millions and billions of traffic. Okay, that's one. Number two, the millennial and the incoming new young consumers are brand and channel agnostic. They don't give a damn. If they see something they like, they don't care where it comes from. So this thing about, oh my God, Walmart is a discount store, Amazon's cheap, you know, it's all gonna go bye-bye. Everybody's gonna be operating on everybody else's distribution platform because you gotta be in every distribution point you can be because the customer expects you to be engaged with them from the time they're thinking about shopping before they, all the way into the store, through the consumption experience, and afterwards. So those retail platforms have to be both digital and physical, and they've got to be in close to the consumer. Think about Nordstrom's local. They are testing big time in L.A. They've got no merchandise in there, but they go into a 3,500-foot one-level store. They go into the neighborhood. They call Nordstrom's local. They go into neighborhoods where they know their customers are, and they have coffee and beer, and they've got a tailor in there. They've got salon, whatever. And while you're in there, they have a stylist who has an iPad with all your information on it, and they engage with you, and they help build an outfit while you're there. And then it's shipped to your home before you even get there. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. We've been going on.
That is still product-oriented. So will experiences become more service-oriented and maybe not as revenue-generating, and then will anybody invest in them?
Well, I think there's something else going on with the brands, just like what Robin's talking about. I'm a much bigger fan of brands than I am third-party sellers of brands. So, yes, I love Nike. I love Tapestry. I love Michael Kors. I love PVH. I love VF and all of those because they have something the consumer wants. And they've built these fabulous brands. And if you're a third-party seller of that, well, that's fine. You can try to put your assortment together and make it all work. But if you're the brand and you can take it direct to consumer, as Nike just showed us last quarter,
right. You
get a lot more to the bottom line than you do having somebody sell it when you give it to them at 50 cents on the dollar and they try to go out and sell it. All you have to do is sell it as best you can on the website. What really matters is can you get the eyes on the site? That's why Robin's going to be right, because the platform is going to be Amazon. The platform is going to be Walmart. It's going to be places where you're already going. And then they're going to build you a storefront that looks cool and not downscale,
So
you can have eyes on a site that feels like your product. That's coming really, really fast.
Alibaba does that. If you're Nordstrom's and you want to get on, it is your store. You have a storefront on their platform.
And that's going to happen. And you're going to buy it on your phone. But it's still going to be experiential feeling, right? Because the reason that you're not going to the store is you don't want to drag yourself to the parking lot and you don't want to have to walk through the rain. You know, there's all these reasons you don't want to be at the store. It's not so much that you don't want to own something. You want it at a great price. You want it to be really easy and you want it to be fun. That's the experience. And you can make that happen online. And we've never been very good at it online. The reason online has worked so far is because it's been cheap and convenient. Now we need to make the experience good online.
Do you know who?
That's where we're going.
And you know who did that, Jan, is Angela Ahrendts when she was CEO of Burberry. The experience online for Burberry was just the same thing you got in the store. It's streaming videos, music, storytelling, the brands that were in there. I mean, when you went on Burberry's site, I don't know what it's like today, but when you went on their site, it was like you were in the Burberry store. Yeah.
But no people. The experience without people.
But you got to be. He's right. You got to be able to do both.
Clearly, you don't play World of Warcraft like I do, where you've got 20 million of your closest friends that are out there playing with you, but you can't see any of them, but the experience is still there. You can shop and have this be very experiential, fun, and even social without any real people involved. I know it's frightening, but it's true.
So should brands be putting more money into digital than they are brick and mortar, or same, or?
They need to stop looking at brick and mortar and digital as being two separate entities. They need to start looking at their platform as being both digital and physical. And the capital investment needs to continue to go in both. And as Jan said, if they can't do it, if they don't have enough, they're going to be out of business. JCPenney doesn't have it. They're in deep debt. Neiman Marcus is in deep debt.
I left them out. I'm sorry. They won't be there either.
Yeah. So you got, I sat in the year-end analyst meeting at Target with Brian Cornell speaking to analysts in Wall Street, whoever was there. And I know you go to these all the time. I happen to be at a very good one because at the end of Brian Cornell's presentation, first of all, presentation was brilliant. He's moving in the right direction. But at the end of it, he said, and I'm going to tell you guys, we have to invest $3.5 billion in 2018. And I'm going to tell you right here, our margins are going to go down. He said, we should be measured by ROIC, return on invested capital. In other words, the investment he's making, he should be measuring on how successful that is. Anyway, that's a good long discussion we could have about just as department stores have to change, Wall Street should have to change in terms of the way they measure these companies. Anyway, as I'm hearing him say, going to spend this and margins go down, this young guy from Wall Street had his screen open, and he was on Yahoo where the Target stock price was, and it went down in real time as he's talking. Unbelievable. But back to the point, the capital investments are, and Blake Nordstrom said, we have to spend like this, up, up, up. And that's one of the reasons they want to go private. And he said, not only is that continual more pressure on margins, he said, we still got the problem with price promoting, and that has always put pressure on margins. Anyway.
So pressure now, and you're saying investors should start to look at companies differently, yeah. which I agree.
Robin doesn't get to make that decision.
With the corporate tax breaks and now tariffs, where are you seeing what is going to happen with retail consumer prices, up or down?
That's right. Because
that's
have
a thumbs
to.
Down. That was a big thumbs down. They're giving it back. The retailers have already started giving back the tax cut. Average retailers got 14 percentage points less taxes are going to have to pay if they're a money-making retailer. The first thing Walmart did was throw out some raises. The second thing they did was say how much they were going to invest in technology. And the third thing they did was say, we're going to beat Amazon over the head with pricing because we're going to give this right back to the consumer.
So,
every retailer that's a maximum taxpayer has gone down that exact same path already. And when the government thinks that this tax cut's going to be inflationary long term, they're right. But short term, it's absolutely deflationary to pricing. And is anybody out there seeing any pricing increases right now in apparel? No, it's down 1.5%. And are you seeing any across the board in grocery? No. Why? Because it's down 1.5% too. Is it because costs are down? No. It's because everybody's tax rate went down by one hell of a lot.
But Jan.
How do I really feel about it?
Yeah, no. But Jan, this is gonna bring all that manufacturing back to the United States. Isn't
it? It's not, and you know it. It's really not. It's not. Boy.
That was great.
No, it's true.
That wasn't the point of
the manufacturing will come back, but the jobs won't.
It was one of the points.
The manufacturing that does come back won't bring any jobs with it.
Right.
You're right about that.
It's machine operators.
It's going to be machine operated.
So a lot of companies are buying back their stock now with their tax break. Is that a good thing? I don't know if that's a crazy question, but is that a good thing, a bad
increases
thing?
Increases shareholder value, but they aren't investing it like Trump predicted. They aren't investing it in Main Street and more plants and more people and higher wages.
They didn't have to. There was no requirements.
That's right. Well,
companies only invest in capital when they've got more stuff to make. You're not going to put it back into it till you have more demand. That's not going to happen.
That's it.
They're going to use it as dividends. They're going to use it as stock buybacks. What happens with that? It goes back into the economy. It may go back to the upper end, but it's going back into the economy. So, no, they weren't going to build more plants just because they had a better deal on their tax rate. They were only going to build more plants if they needed to make more stuff.
That's right. And the demand isn't there.
Perfect segue as far as making more stuff. What's happening with, where do you see, where are we going with fast fashion?
Thumbs down.
Resale.
Oh, I think resale is up and rentals are up, and it's going to continue. Fast fashion, by the way, for these young millennials and Gen X, Gen Zers, fast fashion, paradoxically, is just pouring more and more stuff in an overstuffed world, okay, and faster and faster and faster. And the demand for that stuff at the end of the line, in many cases, are landfills. So I think a lot of the young consumers coming in, I think they're going to start thinking about they do. They put a lot of value in terms of sustainability, where stuff is made, how it's made, and I think you're going to see more and more of that. So I don't know about fast fashion. They're still doing okay, but resale, rent, all that stuff.
This may be an odd question, but do you ever watch football? They have these things called pregame shows where people sit for an hour, 2 hours, and talk about a football game that hasn't happened yet. Well, coming up on the calendar, January 29th, 2019, it's the New York Fashion Week pregame show. That's American fashion podcast with a live audience at the Cutting Room on 32nd Street in Manhattan. It's a Fashion Week pep rally you don't want to miss. Scheduled to appear on stage with us that evening, Hilden Corporation CEO and Twitter savant Gary Wassner, and Business of Fashion Chief New York Correspondent Lauren Sherman, along with some special guests who will be popping up. And starting in January, every Tuesday night, Mouth Media Network will be doing a live show at the Cutting Room for all of our programs, so stay tuned for more announcements about that. Even better, sign up for our invitations list. Tickets for the New York Fashion Week pregame show and other future events in this series are now available at AmericanFashionPodcast.com and on MouthMediaNetwork.com. Tickets start at $25. This is part of Design Flaw, and because it's part of Design Flaw, a nice chunk of those ticket sales go to a fashion industry-related charity. Which charity, you ask? Well, that's to be determined, Wheel of Fortune style, live during the show. There is also showcase space in the lobby. You can get a table to show your stuff or sell your stuff to people in the fashion business. Bring a few models, show off your wares. info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. Email us for more information about that. So that's January 29th, 2019, the New York Fashion Week pregame show. Tickets available now on AmericanFashionPodcast.com and on MouthMediaNetwork.com.
Can a brand work resale into their own model?
Of course.
Sure.
And how do you think?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk resale 1 second. And you can dispute my numbers. I'll be glad to argue with you after this is over. But let's pretend that in 2016, 9 million people bought resale in America. Let's pretend that in 2017, 44 million people bought resale in America. And let's pretend this year, 67 million people are going to buy resale in America.
Is that right?
Do you need to know anything else? If my numbers are right, resale is doing fine. Why would that be? It's the same reason eBay turned the garage sale into the greatest thing you could ever do as far as acquiring stuff that you didn't really need. Now, resale has said, we're online. You don't have to go to the local thrift shop. You can find what you want, when you want it, at the price you want it, which is about 80% less than whatever it was going to cost you if you bought it new. And so everybody's out buying Birkin bags on Real.
Hey,
and is going to be an enormous business because people have accepted owning things that are used. That used to be a bad word. And investors have accepted in investing things that sell used stuff. That was really a bad word. But those two things have both happened. But somebody has gotten the technology together to actually make it available for you to really be able to do it without sorting through some shop that you have to find on some corner somewhere down in Soho. So it works.
Yeah, listen, here's a great example. Patagonia. What's his name, the CEO? His name escapes me. Chouinard. They ran an ad that said, do not buy our stuff. He said, send all of your used or damaged Patagonia goods, send it back to us, and we will fix it, repair it, and send it back to you. This is all, of course, to respect the environmental thing. So, you know, as Jan's right, resale is going to go up.
And I actually think, I think Robin's right on certain niches, because people will buy things because they feel good about it, like Patagonia. They can, they know their customer, they can do things like that. But in general, I think the resale is going to be really important, not because of environmental concerns. I think that will be one of the hooks they can use. But I think it's because now we have a way to actually buy really cool stuff really cheap and do it efficiently and easily. And I think, therefore, if you want to own a really nice high-end bag, but you don't have any money, like you're 25 years old, you've got a way to do that now. And you can feel good about it because it's not new. Nobody went out and had to kill a plastic cow to make it.
There's also the shop ahead when you're traveling thing, where you can order things to be ready when you get to the airport, so you don't even have to take a suitcase, and you don't have to own things for another climate. When you get to that climate, you've already shopped for what you need, and it's rented, and when you leave town, you leave it there.
Well, that may work for some people. I have to have everything tailored. I'm not doing that.
The used car market, by the way, is, I forget the numbers, but it is way up more so than new cars. And all these, again, back to young people, they are renting rather than wanting to own their own homes. They're renting more. So the rental thing is, all that, it's going to go up.
That all does work together, though. A consumer that'll rent your house and use your car will also carry your leftover Louis Vuitton bag as long as it's in good shape. I do think that's a mentality.
I was just going to comment that the RealReal is an incredible experience to shop in, and it's a luxury environment and very different than what a Lowman's or a Century 21 or whatever was. So I imagine there'll be more of them.
If you talk to people in the resale business and you ask them who their shopper is and whose business they're taking, it's very interesting. They will tell you that if they weren't buying it from me, they would be buying it in Off Price, TJ Maxx, Ross, Burlington, those places. I thought when they originally started, this was going to be a department store competitor. They're claiming they're not. They're saying no. When we survey our customers, they say no. If we weren't buying from you, we'd be buying Off Price.
Okay, so I have a quick question. Personalization.
Oh, wow.
Which won't be a quick answer, but aside from predictability and maybe making your own sneakers in whatever colors you want, where is that going?
Personalization, in my opinion, personal commerce, is the next shift in retail. It's starting now, and it's all about data analytics and being able to track and through machine learning, being able to know your customer down to a gnat's eyelash from when they wake up in the morning. I had breakfast with Jeff Gannett before he became CEO. I said, so what's on the top of your priority list, Jeff? He said, I'd like to find somebody about 10 PhDs in analytics. It is on a scale of 1 to 10. Amazon is close to 10. The industry is only at about 2 or 3. Amazon knows what the working mom with two kids living in the northeast corner of Keokuk, Iowa, what she's eating for breakfast, what a brand she wears, the music. And talk about, and they even have predictive analytics in terms. I had a friend who came home from work, and on his porch was a package from Amazon with a light bulb in it, which he hadn't ordered. In the house, an hour later, the light goes out in the kitchen. This is how crazy it is. But it's going to go even further, because it's, as I say, the big stores and the winners, like I think Macy's will be and Kohl's, they are deep into this, and they're deep into it in its first priority because it is low-hanging fruit, because they do have the data, and it is the quickest way that they can begin to bring more benefits to the consumer and therefore increase sales, hopefully.
And if Charles is right about some production coming back and it coming back with no people, it means we're going to make it all out of some sort of 3D printer or something. Right. Personalization gets so much easier. So suddenly can say, I want mine with a giant L. You guys aren't old enough to remember Laverne and Shirley. But in any event, I want mine with a giant L on the front. I can get that at no additional cost. And all I'm doing is buying the style, and then I'm saying, but I really want mine with a red stripe. I want mine with a giant L on it. I'd really like mine with a little different something at no additional cost delivered tomorrow. We will get there with 3D printing.
Yeah.
And automatic knitting and all the things.
But it isn't just product.
It's not just product.
Yeah, because what they'll be able to do is they'll know when you leave your home and when you get within a 1.5 mile radius of Macy's, and it's actually North Face does this, they can ping you 1.5 miles away and say, hey, John, we got a new backpack in here that's got your name written all over it. So this is personalization, bringing them into the store. And then when they get in the store, they've got all those sensors and stuff, and they're being followed around the store. They're getting the dwell points, how much they spend in front of jewelry. I mean, this is going on. And while they're in the store, they can communicate with this person looking at the handbags and say, well, if you get that handbag, there's a pair of shoes that go with that, or, you know, whatever.
But I mean, you could do it while you're asleep, right? They'll just take you through the store. You won't have to make decisions anymore. Yeah. You can close your eyes. Yeah.
The issue right now with manufacturing robots only is that machines aren't very good at touching fabric. They can't touch fabric and pull it a little bit and feel how it's going to work with the sewing needle. So you have to build every machine to do one garment, and that's not how the fashion industry works. We change all the time. So right now we don't have really adaptable machines, and a human can pick up a piece of fabric and understand it very quickly, especially if they're a professional sewer. So right now, robots do not make your clothing. Sure. We've got the sewbots that are from the group out of Atlanta. They're building that factory, the Chinese factory, to make T-shirts, I think, in Tennessee. And then there's the Shimaseki machines that spit out an entire sweater without anybody ever knitting anything. But beyond that very expensive Shimaseki machine and the not-quite-there-yet sewbots, everything's made by hand, really. I mean, somebody feeding material into a sewing machine.
You're exactly right. And the reason that all of the apparel sewing went to Asia is, and there was a term for this, had to do with the touch. They have, the Asians have the best, Joan, what is it?
Manual dexterity?
No. they have the best needle or something like that, because that's why it all went over there.
I thought it's because they needed jobs.
But it's all going to change not that far in the future, because I just met with a young man who's actually, instead of changing the sewing machine, changing the fabric so that you don't have to have a much smarter sewing machine, and now has a huge contract with the federal government making uniforms for starters. Now, they don't have to be very fashionable or very tactile pleasant, but his process makes the material go through the machine as opposed to making a better machine. So, you know, one of those is going to work. We're too far down in the technology for that not to be the case.
I want to thank Charles and Kathy.
Yeah,
and
thank
Robin.
You.
Really a great presentation here.
AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our website, AFPOD is our Twitter handle, and on Instagram we are at American Fashion Show. There's a Be a Guest form on our website. You can also give us feedback through the website, through voicemail at 646-979-8709, or by writing to info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. We occasionally do live events, and to get on the list for free tickets to our live shows, click the live show link also on our website. American Fashion Podcast is produced by the Fashion Media Center for Mouth Media Network. Listen to our sister shows, Fashion is Your Business, Material is Your Business, and Beauty is Your Business, also on Mouth Media Network. This and other episodes are copyrighted by Open Source Business Incorporated and Mouth Media Network Incorporated, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends, remain in force, keep making things beautiful, and keep listening. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.